Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. Welcome to All Exits Closed. My guest today is Steve Greenfield, and we're going to talk about Kamala Harris and her performance at the Democratic debate. So, Steve, what do you think of Ms. Harris?
First of all, I want to start by saying it appears that she's having her name pronounced as Kamala with the emphasis on the first syllable. And I'm going to go with that. I'm going to go with Kamala. Well, you know, about her performance at the debate, it was, you know, utterly predictable. Everybody that is in the Democratic primary, with the exception of Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden on the opposite end of the spectrum, is there to appeal to – actually, I'm going to exclude Elizabeth Warren and Tulsi Gabbard too, because it's they're clearly not running with party establishment approval. But the rest of them, literally all of the rest of them, are running not as general national audience candidates, but as representatives of specific states and specific – demographic groups that the Democrats consider part of their constituent tent and their desired voting pools and people that would tend to support Democrats over Republicans. And they have put this large number of people into the race specifically because Bernie Sanders was coming in as the automatic front runner based on nothing else but his 13.1 million votes in the 2016 primaries. And so something had to be done to sort of break up the attention that would be focused on just two or three candidates. And that's why there are so many of them in this race. And Harris, you know, she has no qualification to be president and no experience or background, academic background in anything that merits attention as someone who's in command of national and international issues. She's there because of demographic components, shall we say, to her that are part of the Democratic Party presentation, right? The window dressing that they put up in front of the DNC department store to turn different people's heads as they're walking down the street. And so, you know, what she was doing there, the reason that what she does is so predictable and what she said at the debate is so predictable, and everyone, of course, is talking about her you know, well-prepared in advance comment about how she was that girl and that it turns out the following morning that she already had tens of thousands of T-shirts sitting in a warehouse with her picture and the phrase, she was that girl, you know, ready to for sale at $30 a pop. And you know, she was using the national audience of the debate as a fundraising marketing opportunity. But besides that comment, there was, you know, as part of that very early on, another comment she made in which she said outright that she is the only person on the platform, on the dais, that is allowed to talk about the race question because everybody else except for her is white, you know. And so this goes right to the usual question that we find ourselves asking, which is that when someone says, I'm the only person who has a valid opinion on race questions because I'm the only one here who is not white, it's very easy to see who they're talking to when they say that. They are talking to white people, you know, who have, you know, that legitimate fear about that question, you know, like, am I speaking out of turn? Am I speaking on a topic that's not for me to speak about because I don't have the lived experience of walking around in a black person's skin? And so that was a very carefully targeted statement to tell, you know, the overwhelmingly white viewership that she needs to be the focus of any conversation about race questions and about race in America. And the reason that that works for white people and the reason she went up in the polls so dramatically after that appearance is because white people, yes, it's actually true. White people do not have the lived experience that black people have, and most particular among the lived experiences that they do not have, that we do not have, right? You and I are both white. That we do not have is being targeted for persecution by the criminal justice system. And Kamala Harris, before becoming a senator, her experience was sitting at the top of two very large criminal prosecution systems that targeted the minority communities, and particularly the poor minority communities. And in fact, her last position, which was as Attorney General of California, was being the you know, the principal executive officer of America's largest and most racist prosecutorial system. You know, if you read the commentary of black people, including mainstream ones like Sean King, and not even just the kind of more difficult to find for intrepid researchers like I am, that speak to smaller audiences and from more left-wing perspectives, but even just a mainstream, you know, daily news commentator like Sean King, speak openly about the fact, about the long litany of black persecution that she mounted. And of course, you know, in tandem with that, the long litany of looking away from rich white banker malfeasance that happened both in San Francisco when she was DA, the Wall Street of the West, the center of the West Coast banking community, and as Attorney General of California, in which she mounted not a single prosecution against a banker, you know, not even against Wells Fargo, which since her departure has become the most prosecuted bank in America, but, you know, received no investigation and no prosecution under Kamala Harris. And while she has a long litany, you know, it's easy to focus on just the matter of how many black parents she imprisoned, literally imprisoned and fined, right, for a law that she promoted about imprisoning parents if their kids don't show up to school. But there were many, many other instances. There was a notorious case of a black person convicted of murder who was on death row, who, you know, received a court order for a DNA test to prove his innocence. And Kamala Harris, you know, mounted a vigorous opposition to providing that DNA test, that one thing to determine yes or no, you know, is it his DNA at the crime scene, when the matter was one of whether the death penalty was going to be applied. There is, you know, a long litany of this, the fact that she imprisoned, you know, of course, the typical situation, right? Thousands and thousands of marijuana offenders of color while looking away from the same crime, which is easily negotiated away down to lesser charges when people can afford lawyers and come from more, you know, white communities where those kinds of resources are available to mount that. There are more instances of this. It was the general pattern. There was the substantial matter of the court-ordered release of nonviolent offenders, right? Because California was found to have an overcrowding problem in their prisons that stems from their longstanding three strikes and you're out rule that Kamala Harris supports. Okay, that means like you can literally go to jail for life for shoplifting a can of tuna fish if you have two previous felony convictions, and that judicial restraint and discretion in not providing a penalty of that kind was removed by the three strikes and you're outlaw. And Kamala Harris supports the three strikes and you're outlaw. And her system was ordered to lower the prison population, with the obvious way of doing that to be to reduce all of your nonviolent offenders, all of your people whose original offense did not represent a meaningful threat to the communities into which they would be re-released. And you could still keep them on parole. You could still require them to show up once a week to pee in a cup and show that they looked for a job and whatever else you have to show your parole officer. But just get them out of the prison. And her department fought back against this court order on the grounds that lowering the prison population would reduce the supply of prison labor. You know, basically slavery, right? There's no other way to say it. There's no nice way to say it. Prison labor is slavery. you know, again, disproportionately black and Hispanic population in the prisons that were there for low-level, you know, marijuana-type offenses in the first place. And Kamala Harris was arguing to keep them in prison on the grounds that California needed their free labor more than the prisoners needed to have their Eighth Amendment violation of cruel and unusual punishment alleviated by court order to lower the population of the prison.
When she mentioned busing, and she referred to herself as that little girl, okay? Now, busing is a lot different than thrown in jail. When she raised the busing issue, it sounded as if she was playing the victim card. But when you throw many minorities in jail, didn't she have any shame in remembering what she did?
Well, it's hard to be a major party mainstream candidate if you have any shame. You know, you have to kind of dispense with the notion of, you know, how to explain the absence of shame. You know, it's not that they lose their shame or have to set aside their sense of shame to be in the positions that they have. They get to the positions that they're in because they don't have any sense of shame. They just say things. I mean, you know, here, take a look at Donald Trump, right? Donald Trump is the most extreme example, right? There is literally, he has no filter. There is literally nothing he won't say. And not only does he have no filter, he has no sense of strategy or advanced planning. He literally lets out of his mouth anything that has popped into his head in the exact moment that it popped there. Whether there are cameras in front of him, whether they aren't, like, there's no there's no control system, no strategy, no planning. So that's probably the most and because of that, it is because of that that he won the election, right? That's what made him appealing to so many people who previously have avoided voting. You ask them, what did you like about him? Oh, he speaks his mind. He says exactly what he's thinking. That was exactly the source of appeal. It's not just politicians that need to be free of the sense of shame. It's any kind of entertainer, right? If you're a rock star or an actor, a Hollywood star, right, there has to be no sense of shame. You actually have to consider it desirable for them to run a headline in the gossip pages tomorrow that you were seen kissing someone that's not your wife, because that gets you in all the papers, and that's what, you know, raises your asking price when your agent books you jobs because of how famous it made you.
A singer, anybody, you know, anybody who has a top 10 hit, who does something, you know, a little risque, that's not the same as electing somebody who's going to vote, that's going to do a vote in Congress that will affect your life. I think there's two different issues here. You think so?
Well, what I'm saying is that in order to be able to achieve widespread fame, a person has to be relatively relatively free of the concept of shame. That's all. That's the only reason I was drawing a comparison. Of course, the impact is not the same. They're not even approximately the same. What she was doing when she brought it up was not playing the victim. Quite the opposite. She was trying to play the beneficiary. She was trying to show that she got where she is because of busing, that she was bused into a mixed demographic school instead of being sent to an all-black school, and that was a big factor, that black people have benefited from busing, and that it was wrong for a white person and then racist for a white person to be opposing it, because the purpose of integration was to provide equal opportunity to black people, and she got bused, and look, she has risen to an important position in life. And she was trying to draw a causative relationship between the busing and where she got in life. And none of that was actually true because, for starters, she was being bused from one mixed race neighborhood to another. She wasn't living in a ghetto. Her parents were comfortably well off, already divorced by that point. And she was being raised by, her Indian mother, not her black father, who no longer lived at home. And she was a middle-class person with her mother and father, both, as far as I know, held doctorates. I know the mother has a doctorate. And so she got to where she is in life with the traditional system that most middle-class and professional-class children have, which is the process of having supported and educated parents who are able to both guide you and give you actual intellectual and material assistance with the things that you're endeavoring to do with your life as you're receiving your childhood training and moving ahead. And the fact of the matter is that just empirically, busing was a failure at integrating schools. Here we are, you know, 40 years after the period she was talking about, and our schools today are as segregated, and in many cases more segregated they were than they were when Brown versus Board of Education was passed, because the real reason we have by the court. The real reason we have school segregation is because we have neighborhood segregation, and we have neighborhood segregation because of cost segregation, right? Housing price and property tax rate segregation, because people live where they can afford to live and reap the benefits of the taxes that they can afford to pay. And the more likely you are to be poor, the more likely you are to be living in a segregated neighborhood with a bad school and needing a bus ride to get out of it to go to some other school. But when you bus somebody, what people are forgetting is that while you are for 6 hours a day changing their physical environment, you are doing that at the expense of several hours of commuting, which they're doing instead of getting enough sleep. They're waking up earlier in the morning for a very long commute. We all know today the effect of adolescent sleep deprivation and what that does to people, you know, psychologically as well as intellectually. They are not doing their homework. They're losing homework time, you know, because they're on a bus. They're not outdoors getting exercise. They're not, you know, home with their families or their communities, building social relations and enjoying the support of their family. They're on a long commute on a bus. And so the people in those communities to which they are being bused are still being left with even more advantages than they had. Is that a trade-off? What kind of trade-off is that to physically move people from a very long bus ride to a different school when you factor in all the things that those kids lose by being forced to take long bus rides that are extremely academically, developmentally important? You know, you created a physical change, right? If a reporter with a camera goes into the school, suddenly you could see that the school is integrated, right? That's visible. But did that produce a net intellectual improvement for the minority kids that were bused to the mostly white schools and to the white kids that were bused to the mostly minority schools? And in addition to that, did it in the long run improve the segregation situation by producing new generations of minorities that can afford to live in white neighborhoods? And the answer to all of those questions was no. Okay, so Harris got where she was. And like, I went to a very bad high school, and so did my brother. And we both got into an Ivy League college because of our parents, right? Because of our parents, because of the family we were being raised in. And busing would have taken the two of us out of our homes for most of the day, away from the thing that was actually making us good students. You know, so busing was a failure at anything besides providing photo ops for people, for politicians to prove that they had physically integrated the schools. You know, but it didn't create long-term integration, and it didn't create any academic benefit to anybody who got bused. It created a lot of new problems. And so what's really happening is that Kamala Harris seized on the issue as a touchstone, because in the days leading up to the debate, people had been talking about Biden's record on busing. And so it seemed like an easy touchstone to exploit, to paint him as a racist and to paint her as the racially appealing candidate. To be the black woman who had benefited from the liberal devotion to integration that Joe Biden, if he had his way, would have interfered with, and that she wouldn't be on that podium with him today had Biden gotten that way. But, of course, that's not remotely an honest appraisal of how she got to be where she was today. She got to be where she is today by being a racist prosecutor in the state's largest racist prosecutorial institution. That's how she actually got to be a senator, not by going being bussed to a mixed race school when she was a child. You know, that's, you know, and so her statement and her T-shirt sales and her insistence that we all invoke our own liberal guilt and acknowledge that she's the only candidate that has a valid input that we need to process on the question of race was all tailored for, you know, materially comfortably white people. This was something that I posted on Facebook earlier today. And I'm actually, you know, going to read it because I want this message to really register with people. Kamala Harris only looks like an anti-racist choice to materially comfortable white people. And if materially comfortable white people do again what they did in the 2016 primaries, and for the same specious reason, it will produce the same general election result and for the same genuine reason. Kamala Harris helmed the nation's largest racist prosecutorial institution and directed its racism. It didn't just happen on her watch. She ran it and made it more racist and speaks of that with pride. That's her resume. If you are a materially comfortably white person, ask yourself why that isn't disqualifying to you. In fact, don't just ask yourself, demand of yourself solid moral and electoral reasons why that isn't disqualifying to you. You know, and then I followed that by saying, friends don't let friends form their estimate of the black vote on the advice of corporate pundits. And that's really what you need to do here today. That's the takeaway from what I'm saying about Kamala Harris and the way she's reoriented her campaign to move up in the polls on race-based baiting of white liberals. There is no evidence in the polls that any black people have fallen, that her ranking of support among black voters has changed at all. The reason she's moved up in the polls is because her ranking has changed among white, materially comfortable white liberals who do not have, as she pointed out herself, but as they're missing the complete irony of it, they're falling for what she said because they do not have the lived experience of black people. But the black people themselves, the reason that their poll numbers in support of Harris have not changed after she made those statements is specifically because they do have the lived experience of living under racist institutions in this country, and they're not particularly concerned whether any of those racist institutions were headed by a physically black person or a person who is physically of some other race. Their concern is about the operation of the institution itself and their knowledge, their absolute knowledge that Kamala Harris made the California Attorney General's office and the San Francisco District Attorney's office more racist than it had been when she took than they had been when she took them over. And I really need that concept to resonate with white people. White liberals, I'm telling you this flat out, sit around for a minute and ask yourselves, how is it possible that Kamala Harris's poll ratings went up so much after that debate among white people, but didn't go up at all among black people? Doesn't that concern you? Doesn't that make you wonder if you are having some kind of programmed response to Harris, and that if you don't have the lived experience of black people, maybe you should acknowledge that and ask black people who have had that lived experience why their poll numbers for her are not going up? Because they have good reasons for it, and they're happy to explain it to you. You know, and I have recounted some of that in this phone call, in the first part of this phone call. Every single thing that I described to you, I was told about by black people, you know, not by white people. You know, and those things don't go away. And in fact, it makes a lot of black people wonder what was the point of white people rallying behind Black Lives Matter and pretend and calling themselves allies and calling themselves woke and thanking black people for bringing these issues to their attention and pledging to be better allies. And then, bam, they immediately turn around and don't accept black input on whether Kamala Harris is really a choice that's going to secure the black vote for the general election in 2020, to which the answer is a resounding no. If black lives matter, if you care about the fact that black people are vastly disproportionately imprisoned, both as innocent people and for minor, marijuana crimes, and that is something they have to carry for the rest of their lives in attempting to get employment after their incarceration ends, then how could you be rushing to support the prosecutor who did that?
You think she's going to remain in the top tier?
Yes. Yes, I do, because who remains in the top tier is determined by white liberal voters. That's the majority that are participating in the primaries. And so she's going to remain in the top tier. I would not be surprised in the least if she ends up getting the vice presidential nomination so that they could at least have that superficial ticket balance of showing that they're interested in, empowering, people of color, whether it's, Indian Americans, African Americans, whatever different proportions of her ethnic composition that they're going to seek to exploit. She's certainly got to be the most viable vice presidential candidate in the entire field. What I'm hoping, against all hope, is that this sudden uptick in talk that she should be the presidential nominee is going to end, and end quickly, and end because white liberals are going to make good on their pledge to listening to the Black Lives Matter movement, which is directed entirely at the criminal justice system, that Harris represents. I hope that white liberals are going to, that this is just a blip, because a lot of people watch the debate. There's always a blip when something's on television, and hopefully, Black Lives Matter voices will chip away at that blip as time goes on so that she's not the nominee. But if she does become the nominee, it dramatically lessens the possibility that Trump will be defeated in 2020, because we saw the way that those assumptions about how different minority demographic groups will vote that were promoted by, the white power structure behind the party and the corporate power structure behind the party, we saw how that didn't get realized, right? We saw that far more black people did not show up at the polls in 2016 as compared to 2012, and that they were concentrated in all of the, all of the purple states, and more than were attributable for how those states were lost, even though everyone said, including the black corporate leadership, that if you were interested in the black vote, that Hillary was the way to go. And then that ended up not materializing. You have the problem with people like you and me, right? People who are of a progressive bent and feel absolutely strongly, regardless of that ridiculous term, purity test, which, let's face it, all that really means is that we have standards, actual standards that we'd like to see our government implement about things that aren't trivial, things like non-defensive war, things like 40.1 Americans in poverty, right? Things like being able to go to the doctor in a country that has a $20 trillion gross domestic product. We are not easily enticed into voting for a Wall Streeter, right, or a warmonger. And all the experts, all the corporate experts told the moderate white liberals that Trump was so terrible that we would all fall in line and vote for the warmongering corporate candidate, knowing full well that we have never, it's measurable, we have never voted for a candidate like that. And there was no reason for white moderates, liberal moderates, to expect that this one time we would suddenly change our habit and show up for their candidate. And so the process is happening all over again. People are being told that this is the received wisdom, this is the generally accepted truth, when we're now here with Donald Trump as president, because we saw in real time, and only 2 years ago, that received wisdom was not so received, turned out not to be accurate. And the most and not just any random Republican won, but truly the most unelectable candidate in the history of major party nominees, the most unelectable candidate ever in all of history, won. And if we are not taking that under advisement now and saying, I really can't listen to you. I have to listen to the voices of the people that are associated with all those voters who didn't show up in 2016, even though you told me they would. I have to stop listening to you for a few minutes and start listening to what those people are saying they need out of a candidate if they are going to show up next time. You know, and you know, because you do this, right? You have this podcast, right? We do everything we can to tell people what we need, what's our minimum that we need offered to us by a candidate in order for us to show up, like, and set aside some of the other things we want because enough of our needs are potentially going to be met. We talk about war. We talk about health care. You know, black people are very open. They don't want cops. They don't want people that headed racist penal institutions. You really, everyone has to listen to the people who didn't show up. Don't listen to the people who did show up because there weren't enough of them to win the election. And so if you want to win the election next time, you have to start listening to the people who didn't show up. And when they tell you what they need, if they're going to show up, they're telling you the truth. You can believe them that they're not going to show up if you don't offer that because they never have shown up. They didn't show up last time, and they're not going to show up again. So that's, like, you know, my closing argument here in this talk, not just about Kamala Harris, but about any of the corporatist and warmongering candidates that are up in the polls and that people are looking at in this primary. If you keep listening to the people who lost the election and don't start listening to the people who didn't show up for that election, you're going to lose the next election as well.
You know something? Pelosi and Schumer are not going to listen to those people. They have their own agenda, and those people don't matter to them.
Right. Well, Pelosi and Schumer aren't going to listen to those people because they're the people that want everyone listening to them. What I'm suggesting is that just as we saw with the Republicans in 2016, when Trump came out of nowhere after being a laughingstock in his previous attempt to run, and after his laughable entrance into the race coming down that escalator with that grim look on his face and boasting about how rich he was and how, you know, Mexicans coming here are rapists and murderers and drug dealers, and how quickly he made all the establishment candidates irrelevant because the voters themselves said, to hell with the establishment. They lost to Barack Obama twice, not once, but twice. We're done listening to you. Right? That's exactly what happened. They lost twice to Barack Obama when all the primary voters listened to what the establishment was telling them they needed to do. And you know, yes, racial hatred was a big issue in why they were so upset about having lost to Obama twice. And so after that happened twice, they rose up and said, we're not listening to you anymore. We're listening to other voices. And that's what Democrats need to do right now, because they're still listening to the voices that told them, that assured them that the fear of Trump was going to bring all the black people to Hillary. They assured them that the fear of Trump was going to bring all the women to Hillary. God, Hillary didn't even do as well with women as Obama had, when she had the potential to make history, to be the first woman president. She didn't even do as well with women as Obama had done. So the establishment said, make this person the primary winner and women will show up in droves. You know, they'll get a 70% response from women. Vote for this one because she's the one the black people are going to turn out for. Vote for this one because progressives, you know, they're not comfortable with corporatists, but they're going to be so afraid of Trump that they're going to turn out in droves. You know what? None of them showed up. None of those people showed up. The women's vote went down. The black vote went down. The progressive vote went down. And they lost, and they lost to the most terrible, horrible, most unelectable person in history. And so my message here today is not to the Schumers and Pelosis and the New York Times and the media that's a mouthpiece for them. I'm talking directly to Democrats. You know, turn yourselves into the Democrat version of Trump primary voters. Stop listening to the people who got over on you and lost to Trump. You just have to listen to a couple of key messages from the people who did not show up, because you only need about 20% of the people who did not show up in order to win this election. But if you don't listen to what it is those people are seeking and try to provide it in the form of a candidate, then they're not going to show up and you're going to lose again. Just laying that out there. It's to the voters, not to the leadership. You voters, go to the groups that didn't show up and ask them what they want. It seems it's so logical. It seems like child's play, right? I would expect to be able to get a four-year-old to understand what I just said.
Okay, Steve, you know what? This conversation will definitely be continued, because you raised a lot of good points, and there's a long time between now and November 2020, and we will have a lot to discuss. So you've been listening to Steve Greenfield, my favorite political pundit. I'm Cynthia Poole. This is All Exits Closed. So if you like All Exits Closed, like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Steve, it's been great conversing with you. Have a great 4th of July, and thank you, everybody, for listening.
Thank you.